This year is brought to you by Eshel Publications. Eshel Publications is a non-profit organization dedicated to spreading the Torah, Shiurim, and Sefarim of Rabbi Aaron Lapiansky. For sponsorships or more information, visit eshelpublications.com.
The old Mav Malkus, the minig here is we speak about a gadol whose yahrzeit is going to be in the month to come. And this time I'd like to speak about somebody who, whenever you open up a Gemara, you almost always meet him. The Rosh in back of the Gemaras, and we always learn it together. The Taisa Rosh or Taisis, the Rosh is almost always, we look at it. And we have to ask ourselves, who was the Rosh? I mean, if you look at it, just it seemed to be someone just sat and learned. His history is incredible history. It covers an extraordinary period of time in Kal Yisrael. And we'll try a little bit to tell about him. Like always, I think one of the most important things when you speak about biography history is, where do I know my material? I have Ruach HaKodesh, but it doesn't go back 700 years ago. And where do I get my information from? So the book that puts it together the best is a book, it's about the Rosh, from somebody named Avram Chaim Freiman, put out Moshe Rav Kook. He was killed in 1948, actually. He also didn't have Ruach HaKodesh going back. We have three mikoros for anything we know about the Rosh. One, the Rosh wrote a lot of tshuvas. And if you go through the tshuvas carefully, you pick up a lot of information about his, what went on. Two, there's a sefer called Minchas Kanos, which was written by somebody who interacted a lot with the Rosh. This person was a big Kanoi. He was very against the philosophy in Limudei Chol in Spain. We'll talk about it later. And therefore, he asked the Rosh to help him a lot. There were letters back and forth between him and the Rosh and Rashba. So the Minchas Kanos does have some of the Rosh's own replies about different things that were happening. And we have one more document that's unusual. His son, Reb Yehuda ben Arash, wrote a tzava to his children, which was printed together with his tshuvas, with the Reb Yehuda ben Arash's tshuvas. And he goes through a little bit of the history. When he speaks about his own history, he speaks about his father's history. So those are the three only reliable sources, but there's quite a bit, and we'll talk a lot about it. The Rosh was born in 1250. As the Jews emigrated out of Eretz Yisrael, so Italy was one of the places they went to. They went up north, and in France and in Germany, there was the major Torah center, which was Rashi and the Baalei Tosfos. For about 200 years, the 1100s, the 1200s, that was the Torah center. And all the Torah that we have Rashi, we have all the Baalei Tosfos Leminehem, we have a lot of Germans from there, Zeruah and things like that. That was all in that 200 period of time. And with the Rosh, this is going to come to an end and move on to Spain. And that's why it's a pivotal point in the history of Torah and Klal Yisrael. The Rosh was born in 1250. He learned by his father, but his main Rebbe, the one that is Rabbi Muvok, was called the Marami Rotenberg. The Marami Rotenberg was the last great Baal Tosfos. He was the end of the Tosfos era. He was the Gadol HaDor. What we have from Marami Rotenberg is mentioned occasionally in Tosfos. But we have a huge amount of tshuvas that have been published. They're a little erratic because it's all these tshuvas where people collected them. So we have different volumes, different ways. But he had an immense amount of tshuvas. The Marami Rotenberg was basically seen as the last Baal Tosfos, and the Tosfos Rosh sort of as his Talmud, as an addendum to that. So he learned by him, and life started becoming slowly more and more difficult. In 1283, there were a lot of Xeris in Germany, and the Rush felt that things are not going well, it's not going to be good, and he actually sent, almost like the Pusik, as Yehuda Shalach Lafan of Goishna, he sent his son Yehuda, who was young at the time, he sent him to Spain, and he actually was the one who helped his father later when he came to Spain to become established. The Maharam Rottenberg is machshim tremendously. There's a place where the Maharam Rottenberg, a letter where he asks, he tells the Rush that he's sick, he's not well, and he knows that if he davens for him, his tefillos will be miskabel. That's for a Rebbe to write that to a Talmud is tremendous. And a few other places where he writes with tremendous, he asks him, there was a tremendous isyachsus of kavod from Rav Rottenberg to the Rush. In 1286, the beginning of the end started. The Maharam Rottenberg was put in jail. The reason was because the German king felt that all German Jews belonged to him. And he obviously wanted to squeeze everything for money. That was kind of the norm. You were not allowed to leave Germany without his permission because you belong to the king. You're stealing his property by leaving. So the Maharam Rottenberg snuck out. He made it to Italy. He was going to go to Israel. And there was a Jewish meshumet who found him, recognized him, and was meisa him, and he schlepped him back to Germany. The king had him put in jail, and he asked for a ransom that would be worth millions of dollars today. That's the 20,000 German marks, which by the cheshbon they make today would be worth millions and millions of dollars. The Rush got together a few others to raise money to get him out of jail. The Maharam Rottenberg refused. He said that it's a halacha that you can't be paid the people for more than they're worth, so as not to encourage the Shabbayim. And the Maharam Rottenberg stayed in jail till he died. And the king kept him afterwards. The king felt at least he could get some money for his bones. And it was years he laid there until finally a very wealthy man paid for his bones so that he could be buried next to him. There was always a little twist to these things. But the Maharam Rottenberg was put into jail in 1286, and in a certain sense, that was the Stimus HaGoyl on German Jewry. Retifa started getting worse and worse. In 1293, the Maharam was Nifta. That was 7 years later. And in 1298, they had a horrible series of massacres called the Rindfleisch Gzeres. Rindfleisch Gzeres was... The word Rindfleisch means beef. And somebody was motzi laz that the Jews had desecrated the host, which is what the Christians, what the Catholics used in their ceremonies, piece of bread or whatever it is. And they just butchered Jews, they destroyed communities, just a pogrom. The word Rindfleisch meaning beef, it wasn't clear if the person started was a butcher by trade or a butcher by the pogrom. But basically, That was the first blow of pogroms, and there were pogroms afterwards. Basically, things were falling apart. And in 1303, the Rush felt he has to leave. It's gone. German Jewry is doomed, and it just got worse. The communities were destroyed for a long time. There wasn't anything doing there. He left. And the only place to go to was southwards. So Germany and France, in the north of France, was where the Baltasars were. In Germany, that was adjacent to it, and that's where they were. He started going further south. And the first place that he went to, it's a natural line, is called Provence. Now, I just want to ha'ara about history. We who drive and fly by plane, distances are not far. A few hundred miles is not far. You can fly in, you can drive a few hours. In those days, I mean, France that we have today would have been way too big of a country to manage. And France was a few countries. And Germany was a lot of countries. They were aligned somehow. They had an emperor, but it wasn't really. You couldn't have such a large mass of land be one entity. So southern France was called Provence, and it was culturally extremely different than northern France. If you take a look, some of the Sfarim we have, any Sfarim de Lunel, anything that's Lunel, Rabbi Anderson mean Lunel, that was Montpellier. These were places in southern France. Southern France had a large Jewish yeshuv, but the rush was there. They greeted him very warmly. They were makabel him, but he was kind of very put off at the low level of Talmud Torah over there. He didn't like it. He felt that they were not learned, and he moved on to Spain. His first stop in Spain was in Barcelona. That was in 1304. That's where he met the Rajba. The Rajba was living in Barcelona, and he was in his house for a week. They farbrang together, and he spent time there. He ended up, a year later, he got a job based on the Rajba's extraordinary strong recommendation in Toledo. Toledo is not far from Madrid, and it's very far. Barcelona is the north of Spain. This is the middle of Spain. In those days, Spain wasn't a manageable country, so they had like a lot of kingdoms. There was Catalonia, and there was Aragon, and there was Andalusia, and Toledo. All these places were like its own little countries. And he ended up in Toledo. At this point, he got a letter from the German ruler, who missed him terribly because he used to ask him for advice. He was a very wise person to Rush. And he told him if he'd come back, he'd protect him, take care of him, everything would be okay. And the Rush politely declined the offer, basically. And you know, no, thanks, but no thanks. But something, there was something the Rush took note of, which he writes later about. There was a tremendous divide between France, Germany, and if Provence and different parts of Spain. France and Germany, as far as we have, are all Shas Poiskim Halacha. You would be very hard put to find a philosophy safer coming from those countries. Provence, Spain, people were extremely involved in the Goyish culture. They studied philosophy a lot. You have a lot of poetry and philosophy emanating from there, even Frum. And there was also a lot of Nat. And there was very, very little learning Gemara and Poskim. We have a handful of, but the Hamoinam, it was not. In France and Germany, learning was Shas and Halacha. That was learning in Germany and France. This was not. And the Rush set up a yeshiva where he taught Gemara and Chidushim of Tosfos and Halacha. In other words, it was something that bothered the Rush. The Rush was very, very bothered by it. He felt it. And he was culturally that way extremely different than the people in Spain. In Spain, there were many people who were, we would call them off the derech. They were totally into the Spanish culture. There was the philosophy, Jewish philosophy. And the problem was there were also a lot of people who got into philosophy, and it distorted the Yiddishkeit. They started understanding the mitzvahs as symbols, and when it's Avram doesn't mean Avram, Avram means the koyach of this, and Yitzhak means the koyach of that, and tzitzis means this. They allegorized the entire Torah mitzvahs, and the Mela didn't keep Torah mitzvahs. That was rampant in Spain. It was, people call it Spain, as, you know, the golden era of Spain. It was golden for people that were not into Torah mitzvahs. But Torah mitzvahs suffered a lot. And the Rush felt it. The Rush writes that he was put off even in Provence, which was better. Provence is the southern part of France before you cross into Spain. And in Spain, in different places also. So he ended up in Toledo. He opened up a yeshiva in Toledo. He became the Rav there. And he had both Beis Medrash, and he became recognized in short order as the Gadol HaDor, especially when the Rashba passed away. His tshuvas give us some very interesting insights. First of all, he had a tremendous amount of, he was very stern. And when he felt that something threatened the good order, he was very, very strong about it and asserted himself. And some of the tshuvas memorable in this regard are as follows. The king had allowed the Jewish community to run their own life, to punish perpetrators of different types in every way possible. They were allowed to fine them heavily. They were allowed to wound them, to maim them. Maiming people was a common punishment in those days, and to kill them. And it's interesting, at the beginning, the Rush wasn't so much, he was kind of aware of it, but there are two memorable tshuvas where he writes about the possibility of killing somebody. One of them was, there was somebody who was a moser, and he would constantly go to the courts and complain about Jews that they're hiding money, they're hiding that, hiding this, hiding the other thing. And the Rush writes that if you warn him three times and he persists in doing it, and in the tshuva it says he invents lies and so on, then they should find a way to kill him. Writes it very clearly. And it's funny, what's interesting, it's a mashmos is that the government allowed it. You know, you can run your own community, and if the government killed people, they could also kill people. That's one tshuva, and that's sort of, I guess, is expected in a certain sense. This person was a threat. He threatened many other people's lives. He had a din of a rodef, and it kind of sets him up in terms of a rodef. But a second case is extraordinarily surprising. There was somebody that sent him, somebody wrote a shaila where this person was a rav of some town, and he felt that the way the Erevs are done are pasul, and therefore he pasuled his town's Erev. He said, any Erev, it's impossible to make an Erev with this goyim there, and therefore he said there's no such thing as an Erev. So the Rush writes a fierce tshuva that the person doesn't know what he's talking about. Every point that the person makes, he refutes. He says it's nonsense. And he writes at the end, he says, and if this person keeps on with his narishkeiten, he has a din of a zakum amre, and he should be put to death. That's what he writes. Very, very strong. Again, I'm not sure. He felt that this person, with his quote-unquote chumrah, which was totally baseless, unfound, is actually being gorim al arachil Shabbos. And if it'll catch on, you'll have many people. People will carry no matter what. There's no Erev, and it'll be Chol Shabbos. But the Rush writes, he calls him Meshugana, and he says if he persists, he's a Zakum Mamre, and he should be put to death. Those were two very extraordinary tshuvas in terms of the severity. Another tshuva that's kind of very fascinating, there was a marriage where somebody wrote up in Arabic a set of rules and regulations about how his property should be sold if he dies, if his wife dies. In other words, there was a standard takana, and somebody had written in Arabic overriding the takana the way he wanted it. The question came in front of the Rush, and the person who brought the question to him had translated that document. The person who made the document, the person who was, he must have been some mediator or something, had written out the whole, translated document, brought it to the Rush, and the Rush decided whatever he decided in the issue. This person disagreed, and he writes, with all due respect to the Rush, but a shy like this should be paskined by somebody who is both Talmud Chacham and knows Arabic extremely well, and not only regular Arabic, but classical Arabic, because that's what it's written in. And he writes, and the Rush took it as a big chutzpah, and he writes back to him. It's interesting, in the tshuva, he quotes him entirely. He writes back to him and says, listen, he says, in terms of learning, I know that you don't know anything. So you certainly, 50% of the qualifications you write, you don't have. In terms of knowing Arabic, it's your translation. So if it's not good, then you strike out on the second count as well. I'm using your translation. And based on your translation, what you're saying is absolute nonsense. So, and he writes on every single point very, very sharp, very strong. And he was very stark about his things. In one or two other tshuvas, he has about minhagim that he felt were bad minhagim. For instance, he writes that in Spain, they're noyig to sweep the floors. We're talking about dirt floors. He said in France and Germany, they acid it. But he said, telling them won't help. They're not going to listen to me. So mutav shiyu shayig. But he said they're not going to listen to him. They used the Torah brings. They used to say on Friday night also Baruch Hashem Olam Amen Vamen. He held as a bracha of Atola, and he said also that in his own little shul he was able to sway them, but in the big community they didn't listen to him. They felt he was an outsider. He was come from Germany and doesn't understand Spain, and they refused to listen to him. Those were some of the more interesting tshuvas. But the big issue was the issue that we're talking about, the philosophy. And here the Rush did have a very central role. Remember, the Rush came from a place where, A, the only learning was learning, Shas and Paiskim, and Shmiras Mitzvahs was Kiriboi. I mean, there may or may not have been people who didn't keep mitzvahs, but nobody made a shita out of it. Spain at that time was learning was kind of very weak. People very into philosophy, people very into secular philosophy, and using it as a lens to understand Torah mitzvahs, and b'meila abandoning Torah mitzvahs. The state of Shmiras Mitzvahs was very wretched. There was a Yid Abba Murray who went on a campaign to Asa learning philosophy. Now, Asa learning philosophy in those days had as much chance as an Issa on the internet today. maybe internet a little more interesting philosophy, but I compare him, those people I think did like philosophy a lot. And so Abba Murray is sort of a kanoi, and he wrote up a lot of his correspondence with different Gdolim and in the Sefer Gol Milos Kanos, and it's a remarkable window into history. The Rashba was the Gadol HaDor. The Rashba tried to keep out of it. Again, it was something that I think the feeling was it's not going to be very popular, it's not going to go well, and sort of what's the point of having that fight? So the Rush, so as soon as the Rush came, the Abba Murray latched onto the Rush. You know, he's got a new person to deal with. So the Rush at first writes something interesting. It's apparent that he obviously didn't understand the what was going on, and he says, well, let's have a meeting with those people and let's work out a pshara where everybody will spend a big part of the day learning, and then they can also learn a little bit of philosophy. Which didn't seem to be Shaykh's. As he stayed longer, the Rush became a much bigger kadnoi, and the Rashba finally came out with a cheirim that nobody under the age of 25 is allowed to learn philosophy. Him and many others signed on it. The Rush writes, when someone asked him about it, he said, I have mixed feelings, because the implication is after 25, you can learn philosophy, and I think that's also wrong. But he said, what do I do? It's better than nothing. But the Rosh obviously was a very big kanoya on it, decided, you know, but in Bal Koryanomen, he had no other choice. But he writes very strongly about it, and later on, his letters and things about it become very sharp. And he was a very important voice, because after the Rashba, he was the Gadol HaDor. The Sfarim that we have, there's one more interesting tshuva. There's a case, there was a very, very complicated case that went from Bezin to the Goyisha courts, and the Goyisha courts also couldn't get a handle on it. It was so complicated. And the queen wrote a personal note to him asking him that he should adjudicate the case and take it on. He wasn't so happy. He didn't want to take it on, but the queen said she feels he's the only person in the country that could adjudicate it, and he should. Since he writes on the queen, you know, in the normal phrase that you write on the queen, on the king, is Yoram Hoidai. He writes the queen this and this, Minoshim Ba'oil Tevarech. That's usually reserved for tzaddikis. I don't know exactly about that queen in Spain, but it's interesting. I found that interesting that he writes it like that. The Rosh himself left over the following sfar. The Rosh on all of Shas, which is interesting. He had the riff. Obviously, he brings the riff. But it's a condensation of Gemara. But the big difference in him and the riff is the riff has only the Gemara and occasionally a machlekes of Goinim. Very occasionally, that's it. The riff incorporates Divrei Tosfos. In other words, Tosfos becomes halacha to us through the Rosh. The Rosh took Tosfos, which is Derech Pilpul, Shaka Vataria, made halacha out of it. And we have that and all of Shas, that's incredible. The Rosh wrote a Pirush on Mishnayos, which we have some of it in Tyrus, in Zeroyim. I'm not sure if the Pshat is he only wrote it on there, or he wrote everything, they only have it there. The Rosh wrote a Pirush on Shas. We have it on the Nedarim, like Rashi. I don't know, again, if he wrote it just on the Nedarim because there was no Rashi there, or he wrote it on all of Shas, and we don't have it, they didn't print it, I don't know. But he did write those Pirushim. The Rosh wrote Tshuvas, which we have. Now, they were put together in a bit of an unusual way. They're put together as klolim. In other words, a klal is a bunch of Tshuvas, different times, different places, but that deal with a common topic. Whoever put it together that way. The Rosh wrote a small Musa Sefer, Orches Chaim, which Rav Reingold learns every El with the Olam. It's a very small, it's like very short, it's like different things to do every day, and very short and small, but with a lot of tochen to it, if you learn it correctly. And that became very popular, like during Elul, to learn and to take one sentence, one hanhag each day, and to discuss it. He wrote on Chumash, but it's very hard to figure it out. There are like three, four, five different likutim of Bali Tosfos on Chumash. Hadaras Kenim, Moishavs Kenim, Pirush Rosh HaTorah. He definitely wrote a Pirushim, and it's definitely in it, but what he wrote exactly, which one and so on, unclear. The Tosfos HaRosh is actually Shiurim that he said in Yeshiva. And there's a document in the Tshuvas, very fascinating document, where the Tshuvas is about somebody who was married, went on a trip, and disappeared. Aguna case. And there's an edus of somebody who met with this person, and this person fell ill while he was there, and it was nifta. So the person who wrote this testimony was reliable. The question was, how to identify that this was actually the same person? So in the tshuva it's written, he said that so-and-so came and said, I was in this inn, and I met a young person named Rev Asher. The Talmud's name was also Rev Asher. And we were schmoozing, And he showed me a certificate that the Rush signed that he had learned in his yeshiva. I don't know if they got credits in those days or BTL, but whatever it was, he actually had a certificate. And he showed me some of the chidushim, some of the tosfos that the Rav had learned in his shir, that the Rosh had learned in his shir. And based on that level of identification, he was able to accept his edus. So it was fascinating. Tosfos Rosh were actually shiurim that was said in yeshiva. Somehow it seems as if the Rosh gave some certificate of some sort that a person learned by him. Not clear what it is. It just said he showed him a note that had been signed by the Rosh himself that he was a Talmud, that had been a Talmud as yeshiva. The Rosh himself was Nifta in 1327, Tes Cheshvan 1327. It means the Yahrzeit said it'll be in a week, in this week. There's one said epilogue to it. In 1491, the people in Spain knew that the end is near and things are really gone. The Zkenim of Toledo decided to destroy the cemetery in Toledo so that the Goyim don't desecrate it. So they totally got rid of all the matzevis and plowed it up, and we don't have a zecha anymore of the Rosh's caver, even though we know what city it was, we know exactly everything about it. But in 1491, they destroyed, the Jews destroyed all the matzevis because they're afraid that the goyim would make, put salems on, who knows what. Al kaponim, so we don't have the caver, but we have the Rosh. We have the Rosh in the back of the Gemara, which is unthinkable to have a Gemara without a Rosh. We have Tosfos HaRosh, which we share. We use it all the time to enlighten us about the Rosh himself. We have the Tshuvas of the Rosh, which are, the Tur brings them constantly. Obviously, it's his son. The Tur was his son. And the Tshuvas HaRosh, each one is, you know, it's a marker for Pesach, Tshuvas HaRosh is very important. We have the Orchas Chaim HaRosh, which is an invaluable Musa Sefer, learned many times, many different Bali Musa used it. And this was really the change, where basically this was the end of that kuf of German-French Jewry. There wouldn't be a Chashva Yisra for a long time. And it transitioned. He brought a lot of the strength of French and German Jewry to Spain. The Dagesh on Talmud Torah, the cleaning up shop in this mishmash of philosophy and mitzvahs and Torah and halacha and the whole thing. And this sort of sealed one era Klal Yisrael of German Torah Jewry, German Jewry, and it enriched and gave us a whole new level of Torah coming from Spain and so on. Yizichar Baruch.